Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy, and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, this is the Southern Fork. Unscripted kitchen chats, and also studio chats, with some of the most interesting voices in the culinary South. I'm Stephanie Burt, a food and beverage writer based in Charleston, South Carolina, who travels with her fork to write for a variety of publications, from magazines you might have on your coffee table to the website you love to visit for your favorite recipes. And I'm inviting you to come behind the scenes with me to get to know the people who make this Southern culinary landscape so special. I'm always hungry for the next bite, thirsty for that next sip, and ready for the next conversation. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by Smithy Ironware. By now, if you've listened to this show, then you know how my relationship with this cast iron company has blossomed through the years. From first interviewing founder Isaac Morton to now developing recipe content for their website. My relationship cooking with cast iron in my home kitchen has grown too. Since I've been using my 12-inch Smithy skillet for a couple of years now, it seems the more I use it, the more I want to use it. And it's never hard to clean because I have one of their signature chainmail scrubbers that I can keep by the sink, pop in the dishwasher, and reuse. It's sustainable, something you know I love, and I'll also put that scrubber to work on my glass baking dishes too. As a special gift for Southern Fork listeners, Smithy's giving away a scrubber with every purchase from their site that uses the code SFORK19. Visit smithyironware.com, that's Smithy with an E, S-M-I-T-H-E-Y, ironware.com, to check out the growing line of skillet sizes. And remember, at the checkout, type in the code SFORK19 to get your chainmail scrubber. Now, if you like whiskey, then prepare to get thirsty. A holiday weekend is upon us, and plenty of children are going to be on the hunt for hidden eggs. On that note, have you ever heard of Easter eggs in video gaming? Well, it's a secret feature that, when found, unlocks a whole new level within the game, a special delight, or an added bonus. You have to go hunting for them, and if there are Easter eggs in the world of whiskey, then chances are Bill Thomas of Washington, D.C. knows all about them, or is on the hunt. He's the whiskey mastermind behind Jack Rose Dining Saloon in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of D.C., and it's a restaurant and bar that houses more than 2,500 bottles at any time for the pouring. His encyclopedic knowledge of whiskey comes from a passion for enjoying it, for the people who put great craftsmanship and care into the making of it, and from watching new stars rise in the business. Are you interested in how to build a whiskey bar beyond the corner store selection? Then listen on. So welcome to the Southern Fork, Bill.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And actually, as per usual with the Southern Fork, I'm coming with very little equipment, just a Blue Yeti mic, no headphones, no fancy, you know, photographers or anything. And thanks for having me up to your hotel room here in the Francis Marion.
That sounds so much more tawdry than what's going on here.
Exactly. Well, and we should say there are other people in the room.
Wait a minute, that's even worse. Yeah, this is the best podcast ever.
And we've already cracked bourbon. See, it's we're not going to be able to.
This is how we ended up in the hotel room.
Well, great. Well, we're here today to talk about bourbon. I'm fascinated. I just have to say, I've never spoken to someone that has one of the biggest whiskey collections in the Western Hemisphere. That's the title when I Googled you.
Is somebody else coming in?
So, let's talk about that. Before we have to discuss what you poured for us here, since we can't have a bourbon podcast or a whiskey podcast without whiskey. So cheers.
Cheers. We're drinking Old Rip Van Winkle 15-year-old bottled in Lawrenceburg when Julian Van Winkle III was the owner of the old Hoffman Commonwealth Distillery and used it as his bottling line before moving his operation to Buffalo Trace. So this is right after the family stopped having an agreement with Stitzel mm-hmm. and then moved right over to Hoffman Commonwealth around, I guess they were doing that by 80 in the early 80s. So he did that for a number of years.
So, Southern Fork listeners, you've finally come to the reason why I actually do the podcast, which is to get opportunities to taste things like this. And can you explain the tasting notes and of this besides just pure velvet?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a 15-year-old, which is great because obviously the only we don't get access to much 15-year-old juice. This particular one has always been one of the favorites, and I was lucky enough to... before you discontinue this would be what you would commonly know today as Pappy 15, mm-hmm. back when it was the Old Rip Van Winkle 15. And it's weird. I remember when they were dumping the SKU before they did the switch, mm-hmm. and I was buying these up in discount bins in Kentucky.
Wow.
For $25 or whatever. Wow. And now I think the last one I bought was like $1,300 or $1,500. So it's a different world. So this is...
This is a different world.
It's crazy, but
this is very different than the usual that I drink during the week at right? home. So
yeah.
Just heads up.
It is different than what I normally drink as well. But Julian, what he did back then during that whole Hoffman Commonwealth mm-hmm. era of bottling there was just probably he'll go down as the, you know, for that time period, the best independent bottler in American history. I mean, mm-hmm. it's
right.
that whole series of stuff that he put out and the different labels that he put out for hotels and put out for different bars and restaurants. I mean, those have become some of the most sought-after bottles in the market, and that's what we're drinking right now.
Wow. And it's 11:57, so that's okay. That's yeah. fine. I mean, it's Charleston Wine and Food. It's all
yes.
right. So we wait until after 9, so we're good to go. One thing that I'd like to really talk about today is building the education that makes you a collector. So obviously you had an affinity for whiskey and you were interested in it and you became an aficionado. When did it switch over to actually understanding I can build a collection?
It never actually switched. There wasn't I'm building a collection.
Mm-hmm.
It was just going around and buying up all the bottles that we wanted to serve at the bars.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all it was. We never, you know, the funny thing is back and I was fortunate enough to be on the early hunting days when you would walk in the liquor store and always find something amazing that
right.
was left over from the 70s or 60s or
and
or
we
early
should
80s.
Talk about that moment, which is a little, there is a situation where I've known plenty of chefs and distillers that go to the out-of-the-way liquor stores in the
right.
small towns. Like, you know, see that one with the three red dots that looks a little sketchy? You're
yeah.
going to always do a wheelie and turn
yeah.
in there
yeah.
because that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that in the old days, it was just you literally could walk out of liquor stores, and I did many a time, with 30 to 50 bottles of old stuff. I think those days are pretty well gone now, but there's a lot of current releases that are highly sought after that you can still find. So for us, there's still some excitement in doing
mm-hmm.
that. For the most part, it's really private deals between whiskey people,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So you start buying, instead of like, I buy one bottle, two
right.
bottles, you know, I will buy repeat bottles, maybe a case of something that I know I'm going to love. But going to that volume and then having the restaurants gave you a place to kind of just slide into that because you knew you needed volume in order to put it on
yeah.
the menu, right?
This one that we're drinking right now, the Old Rip 15, was one of our favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And this on my original menu was $9 for 2 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't know what it is today, but it's pretty expensive. It's probably in that, I would guess, $100 for an ounce range
yes.
now.
Yes.
And we bought these up, just like we did many of the other bottles, because that's what we wanted to offer to the guests, and we wanted to stockpile it. So it wasn't even about, oh, these are going to be highly sought after. These are going to be... we wanted to supply every guest that came in with the best whiskey we could. Mm-hmm. So when we were buying up the old Forsters and the old Taylors and the old Fitzgeralds, when I was going to liquor stores and there was tons of the 70s stuff still sitting out there, I was only buying the bibs, the bottled and bonds, because that's what I like to drink. So that's what I wanted to offer to the customer. Mm-hmm. And I would leave those 86 proof ones there, which today people are like, you're out of your mind that we're so much money.
Right, right.
But that's not what...
You were that, going based for the whiskey, on what my you're palate. Tasting.
Yes, yes, exactly.
The idea of having a place where you're sharing... It's different than just, hey, this is cool, and we need to have the most expensive shit on the menu. It's like, how can I share what I love? Like, so it's a community that you're building, correct?
Absolutely. And back then, there was really no community. You know, I mean, you know, you would go to a thing like the Kentucky Bourbon Festival in Bardstown, and there you would be around a real community of people. But building that within the city of Washington, and it wasn't there at first. And it definitely wasn't an expensive thing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you came in to drink, you were drinking, you know, H. Hirsch Gold Foil and, you know, Distiller's Masterpiece Port and Cognac and, you know, all the Van Winkle stuff. Mm-hmm. And you weren't even thinking, anyone could afford it. They were all affordably priced.
Right.
And
if you were into that sort of thing, it was something that was a worthwhile purchase for you.
Yeah, the
you
the
know, like
age.
If you're into like $3 or 2-for-1, it's not going to be. But,
right.
You know, like $9 this.
Yeah, yeah, but
it's totally worth it.
Yeah, and all those, the funny thing is all of those whiskeys were so affordable that even if you weren't into them, you were getting these amazing drams that perhaps maybe spurred your interest, or then all of a sudden you're like, what am I drinking? And then you became a devotee, right. And then you were, and I think that's kind of what was so great about that time period of the 90s and the early 2000s, up and even to 2010, 11. Mm-hmm. Was you had a lot of affordably priced, amazing whiskeys that were just on at every bar shelf, mm-hmm. Whether by luck or by design. But you could travel the U.S. and you could find some pretty amazing stuff.
So building that palette, I get this question a lot. Like, we are, you know, I used to be, I went to school, I was an educator, and then I realized I can just learn about what I want to learn about out in the world. You know, self-education right. is a big thing, and the palette is an experiential thing as well. But building that, finding that one thing, like you're saying, that key,
right.
that where you're like, whoa, I'm a devotee of this now.
Yeah.
And now what else, one of the best questions right at the bar for you to hear is, what else tastes like this? Why, you know, I like this
right.
aspect of this.
Yeah.
What else do you have in that vein, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a typical question when we get called to the table as a whiskey advisor mm-hmm. and someone is looking at the book and they're trying to go through all these pages and they're like, you know, we're asking them, well, what are you in the mood for tonight? Mm-hmm. What is there anything particular, you know, what flavor profiles are you looking for or whatever? And then there's always that, well, what do you typically drink? Mm-hmm. Now, do you want an extension from that, or do you want to go a different direction? And sometimes it's a baby step towards something in that same kind of line extension, and sometimes it's a completely different path. Well, I've been hearing about, you know, different styles of whiskey. So mm-hmm. you might drink a bourbon, you might move to a rye, you might be like, you know, I want that a little more spiciness with a rye, or you might be like, you know what? The American whiskey category is growing. What do you have that's, you know, and my favorite distillery is X. Are they producing anything that's an American whiskey, or are they doing any ryes, or mm-hmm. Are they doing any cask finishes? Mm-hmm. And you just kind of like listen to the guests and try to pull the best whiskey off the shelf that's matching what they're in the mood for. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what we're doing today, drinking. We're such a sophisticated drinker now. Mm-hmm. We've had now, you know, a good decade to 15 years of like the cocktail revolution coming. And I think the one thing I always say is that people are drinking quality, and they're also drinking according to their mood.
It's
so you
very
have
true.
To hear their mood.
Yeah.
You know,
and
what
so
are they
when people,
for?
When I sit down at a bar, people say, what do you normally drink? Well, I love all of it depending on the mood.
Right.
You know, so like if I'm sitting at a beach bar with my flip flops on, I don't want to have this.
Right.
This is perfect for right now, by the way.
Yeah.
But because this is the moment for this. But that kind of situation of letting the palate and the mood really, really decide that. I think for me, it's been surprising to see the generations after me, the millennials, that come and you actually have, like, more advanced, they come out, they want to learn versus having to, like, break old habits, like, from the pre-cocktail era.
Yeah, absolutely. And the millennials are great because they do research before they come in. Mm-hmm. And they might, they're like, been reading up on these bourbons. I've been reading up on these gins. I've been reading up on, mm-hmm. you know, I really want to try your, you know, different versions of old fashions, mm-hmm. you know? So they come in educated, and you're just like, wait a minute, you're 22 right. years old, 23? I mean, I have an amazing, two amazing whiskey advisors right now. Brittany Morgan and Chris. And they were so young. And like when they walked in the door, they were already fairly knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how is this possible? You couldn't, right. this is what we did drinking dram by dram over a decade. And you guys are walking in the door and there's no way that you tried all that.
Yeah, but
you're
my
so...
20 was, you know, watching the Dave Matthews Band in a club show drinking Miller Lite.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my year 20.
Yeah.
Right? Not, well, you know, I mean, I did see him before he got big, whatever. But, you know, not understanding and Googling Willet and their new expressions for, you know, that are coming out this season. I mean, yeah, that's a different world.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I mean, obviously the advent of the smartphone.
Yes.
Changes industry dramatically because people were able to, in an instant, no matter where they were, whether they're in a liquor store, whether they're in a restaurant or bar, they could pull up the information they were looking for. You know what? Blah, blah, blah. And it's just, that really has helped move us so much farther.
Right,
just
having I have that never instant. Thought about that, but you're exactly right. Yeah, that's true. Because you can even look at the menu and go, I don't know what I want. And then, like, but that looks good. Let me Google it first.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, okay, yeah. I see that, you know, a lot of people are saying this is good. Now, right. I mean, obviously, a place like Jack Rose, the staff is so well educated on spirits that they're your instant right. smartphone right, right there. I mean, you have a human smartphone.
And you can put down the smartphone and just enjoy the whiskey.
Yeah. And there's that rapport when the customer comes in that they'll be like, they have their bartenders. They have, I mean, we have this. We have people that come to Jack Rose maybe once a quarter, maybe mm-hmm. once a year. And the great thing is we don't have a tremendous turnover. People generally stay for years and stuff. So they come in and they want the same waiter. Mm-hmm. They want the same bartender because they've built up this rapport. I mean, I don't know how many times a waiter comes to me and goes, oh, we have a regular. They come in. I mean, I don't know them. But they are intimately like they texted the waiter. This happened so many times. They texted one of our staff members to say, I've made a reservation. Are you working? I want your section. And this is what I want to drink. And the waiters will come to me like, hey, Bill, we don't have this bottle on the shelf. They want, can you get it by the time they come in? I'm like, we can get anything by the time someone comes in. I mean, mm-hmm. there's nothing. And I had a guy walk
in. That's so cool. That kind of gives me a little chill.
It
is amazing.
I mean,
that's so neat. Also, that's something I want to do moving forward.
Yeah. I had a couple come in one time. It was their anniversary. They were huge whiskey drinkers. Both of them were just phenomenal. They knew their stuff. And they walk in the door. They're like, we are here for 4 days. Mm-hmm. We will be here every night. Here is our list. They gave me a 3-page list of every whiskey they wanted to drink. And what they would do is they would drink. We'd do like small half-ounce pours. Mm-hmm. They would drink. I think the first night they drank, as soon as we opened, they drank a bunch of them. Then they had dinner. Then they went back to drinking. The next night they came in, did the same thing, but then they went someplace else for dinner, then came back after dinner and continued. And when they handed me that 3-page thing, and I was like, I looked at it, and I was like, they were like, can you have them here? And I was like, I can have every one of these bottles for you by, before, during this 4-day stretch. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. And they just literally check mark. They just, and that's what we do. We have people that fly in once a year. They have their list, and this is what they want to check. And it's really fun to actually be challenged sometimes. Can we get them?
So for Southern Folk listeners, a lot of times when you hear about this kind of level of collecting, whether it be wine or whiskey, in the food world, you have to connect it more to the visual art world than you do to just the consumable world.
Right.
But it is a consumable. So yeah. I'd like to ask a couple questions about that. One, a lot of people have a really hard time ever even opening a bottle like this.
Right.
So how do you, I mean, like you can't think about the $500 a pour, but you have to think about that because that's your business.
Yeah.
So how do you weight that? And you go, I mean, you know, this is a life is beautiful moment for you to answer, but.
Are we saying that in my, like if I'm at home cracking
yeah,
a
like
bottle like
how
this?
How in the world do you decide this is the bottle, besides just the mood, but this is the bottle I'm ready to open and share? Because a lot of people, this might be the most expensive bottle on their bar.
Right.
by nature. So getting over that idea of how much something costs versus and its expiration, in other words, like there's only so much of it versus right. the enjoyment. Some people get so stressed out about that they can't enjoy the whiskey.
I definitely think even if you look at it in a price perspective of what you're opening, the moment that you've kind of gone down that path that these are the people I want to drink with, tonight is a night that I want to do it, that value far exceeds any value of the bottle that you're going to open. So it's not an issue. It is really just, this bottle's here. These are the people I want to drink it with. Crack it. I mean, it happened to me the other night. I cracked open a $3,000 bottle of Macallan just because the right people were there. And I was like, let's do this. Let's drink it. And then, I had already cracked this bottle. And then we were at Jack Rose and some regulars come in. We drink at Jack Rose. And then I was like, oh shit, it's your birthday. This is a regular. Let's go back to my house. Let's drink some more of this bottle of Macallan. It's here, So here it is. I'm actually taking customers out of Jack Rose to go drink for you at my house, which I'm the worst businessman, but they're good people. I mean, these people are your friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in this whiskey community where everyone is so, I don't think there's a more just generous group of people. Mm-hmm. And I could, like I say, couch surf my way across the U.S. and probably my way across Europe. And we have friends everywhere, Australia, England, Scotland. And when you're there, they crack open these. They do the same thing. They're like, you know what? I'll just grab this expensive bottle.
Because there's nothing better than sharing with somebody. This is all what we do are all bubbles. Everybody's in your bubble. And when you have somebody who appreciates what you appreciate, you're already like on a different level. You're on a different playing field. Yep. So that communal sense can really go up from there.
Yeah. I remember there was a person who got a job in an ambassador role for a particular brand. And I was discussing whiskey with them. And then I was like, wait a minute. They've learned their one, but they didn't really have the appreciation of the... So I was like, let's go back to the house. And we ended up... And I ended up cracking open so many just on an education level. I was like, okay, this is when...
Because that's fun. It's just fun to watch somebody try something for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, by the way, this is one of the best things I've ever had. I mean, I just... Then I get embarrassed and effusive, and so we just have to move on. No. But how do you care for whiskey bottles when you start building a collection? Obviously, there's cellars and things like that for wine. So how do you take care of the collection, both yours and also the restaurants?
I mean, the great thing about from Jack Rose is we're selling 10,000 bottles a year by the dram. So bottles really don't last that long. So they flip quite a bit after they're open. So that being the case, Jack Rose is kind of this living inventory that's flipping constantly. And it's just, you don't have to worry about it. Obviously, at your house, if you're going to hold stuff for years, which is generally like some people will open a bottle like this and it could stay open for 3 years, 5 years. Right. My buddy in St. Louis, I was just at his house, and he's got tons of bottles. Keep it in a fairly cool, dark place, no sunlight, not huge temperature swings. The same thing you would care for a wine in a sense, but, obviously you don't store it on its side because you don't want that cork to get eroded by the high alcohol content. But this one that we're drinking today has a plastic seal, capsule. You could store it on its side. It's not going to, but you wouldn't anyways.
Right.
You could potentially, anything can leak. So why chance it? But yeah, I mean, I just think you have to care for bottles the same way when you think about it. Although it doesn't have the volatility of wine, you should still treat it with respect and give it the reverence it deserves if you want to hold on to that bottle for a long time. So
that's great advice. Since we've talked a lot about collecting, and I know you can give me a laundry list of what you're really excited about now, including somebody that is a friend of the Southern Fort, can you give me a couple, just like two or three, things that you're really excited about right now? In whiskey world?
Probably, there's certain distilleries that are doing an exceptional job that have only maybe been distilling for the last 2 to 7 years. And now that you're starting to see their stuff become 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old, you're like, there's an identity. These are amazing. And the more distilleries, probably the most exciting thing is when you have that many distilleries going on in the U.S., and you're finding these 10 gems or whatever, mm-hmm. that adds 10 more people producing a lot more juice. That means hopefully you can find something that's affordable. Mm-hmm. That's the most exciting thing that's happening right now.
Because we've had an explosion of distilleries in the U.S., and I don't know if a lot of people really are grasping that, but it's a huge number.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you've had a huge number, but not a huge level of quality, I would have to say.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But there's enough when you think back to when we were just dealing with, say, 9 or 10 big distilleries in the whole U.S. for the most part. You had a few, I mean, you had Old Potrero out in San Francisco and stuff like that, but you were really dealing with the core group of Kentucky distillers. Mm-hmm. And now that they've become so popular, once you got past that 2010 range, 2012 range, and everything was getting bought up and prices were going up and, you
know. It became a fetish instead of actually the enjoyment. It's like, I want to say that I have this, not that I enjoy this or that I even know why I would enjoy it.
But you also have a lot of people that love those whiskeys and are bunkering a larger quantity of them, which means one person now is pulling off 10 or 20 bottles of the same thing as opposed to just buying one and two. And I don't blame them. I always tell everyone my first bit of advice is if you find something you love, buy as much of it as you can because especially if it's a single barrel or a special release, you're not going to have another option to get it. Or if you do have an option to get it, it's going to be an expense that you're just like, you really don't want to pay.
Yeah, and then you're like, I could have bought that, but then, you know, it's really difficult, really difficult.
Yeah. So the new distilleries that are producing, there's some really good ones out there right now that are going to be game changers, I think, in our industry. And I also think that some of the big distilleries are expanding their line, mm-hmm. which is great because, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Old Forester 1920 comes to mind that I think was a great line extension from Brown-Forman. And having an affordable whiskey like that come out from the big guys is great, taking some of that pressure off, having an everyday drinker that's affordable. But then you'll get the Henry McKenna that all of a sudden started winning these accolades, mm-hmm. and now I see this 1995 gem, $39.95, you know, on mostly liquor stores, or now it's allocated, and, you know, that's somewhat of a disappointment. But then you have Peerless coming into the market, you have Wilderness Trail coming into the market, you have Willett finally pumping out, their stuff is 5 and 6 years old, pumping out a ton of stuff. You know, High Wire, which I visited yesterday, which blew me away. I was just like, I'm looking for those next distillers where I'm like, this is really going to be a game changer in terms of having something new to drink. Here's the funny thing. These guys are young. They're, you know, some of these whiskeys we're talking about are 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, and they're amazing. They're drinkable now. It's because they started with great corns. They created a great mash bill. The distillate coming off the cuts were great. And now we're seeing that a 2 year old whiskey can be really good and a 3 year old whiskey can be really good. I think we had this kind of boom in the industry where we were getting a lot of year and 2 year old stuff that wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. So now you see these guys rising out and you're seeing the best ones and you're just like, okay, I need to make sure I get a barrel of this before, you know, that's what I'm thinking. I think by the barrel now, as opposed to the bottle, I think of what connections, and people that I can visit and kind of, once again, I always talk about going on the journey with them, mm-hmm. you know, start mm-hmm. now because these guys are going to be untouchable in another 5 years mm-hmm. and everyone's going to want their stuff. So, you know, I just hope they remember me in 5 years when I was like, hey, remember I stopped by.
Remember, and I liked that.
You know,
I really liked that.
You know, you in the back of the line. Have you been here before? Come on. All right. That's
You're
what
like,
I'm hoping.
Yay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we're at the end where I'm going to ask four questions. Those questions that I ask at the end. And the first one is, what makes you hungry?
Wow. In terms of, like, thirsting for new whiskeys or in terms of...
Esoteric or everyday, your choice?
I think everyday, just the pursuit of the next great whiskey. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a lifelong journey. It's something that we've learned that there's always, you know, if you put aside preconceived notions of what you like and you're willing to try and go through, you'll find this next gem. So knowing that that's out there, knowing that there's someone somewhere in the U.S. or Scotland or Tasmania... you know, that is producing some great whiskey that you don't know about yet, that's pretty awesome. And I know that there's a bunch of other people out there that I just need to get on the road.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When I have a little more time, I will drive mm-hmm. across country. I really want to drive across country and just hit some young distilleries and see what's going on.
There's a podcast that you can listen to on the way. I just heads up.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll let you know. Number two, what does some aspect of what you do say something about your personality? So obviously your identity is much bigger than what you do on a daily basis, but there's something that attracts you in your personality to this kind of work.
I've always kind of been hospitality driven. Mm-hmm. I've always liked, it's funny, I was in the video store business before this, which is crazy, from when I was a kid, like 10 years old until I got into the bar business. And, you know, I got to see those customers every day. I got to know what they liked, film-wise.
Bill and Ted's 2, 3.
Yeah. And it was great. I mean, you were just like learning the customer, what they're looking for, trying to take them in a different path. I've always appreciated that. So I think this industry kind of lends itself that, you know, I'm out there always trying to get something that someone's going to enjoy. I just love the hospitality side. So I don't know what is that. I don't know what that says about my personality, but I just want to deliver the things people are looking for. And if it's, the harder it is to get for them, the more I want to get it for them.
Yeah, so it's kind of fun.
Being that hunt, I guess the hunt.
Yeah, you know? So you're like a fixer.
Yeah, I guess. a fixer. That's this is a drug, but I don't know. I don't want to say fix.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, like, more of... Never mind. Anyway. Number three, what keeps you up at night?
The fact that, you know, right now we're building two new restaurants and we have Jack Rose and we're doing the bottling and we're buying barrels and we've been laying down barrels for years now. And it's all with one mission, which is to create the best collection and, you know, special stuff through the barrels. And the fact that everything takes so much time, aging wise. And, you know, I mean, we're thinking 20 years out, 50 years out. And will I be able to accomplish it? You know, will there be enough time? Will there be someone from the staff or from the family that'll, you know, if we put these, you know, I plan to put them in a trust and just somebody run with it. So hopefully just having people that'll continue to do this. And I just hope that, you know, in the next 10 years, Jack Rose will, you know, we always say we're not creating restaurants or bars, we're creating institutions. Mm-hmm. And I hope that it reaches that kind of level of status in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So that's it. Just building Jack and the other restaurants as a kind of a cohesive team and putting together the staff that can afford to stay with us.
Right.
You know, and that's a really a big problem in our industry right now.
Right.
How do you create jobs? Because it is really a young person's game working behind the bar, you know, so what do you do with
late
these
nights, physical?
Yeah.
I mean, just beyond, you know, just the lifestyle that we've heard a lot about this year. It's just a very physical job. You're literally off, you know, working second shift at a factory. It just happens to be in public.
And yeah, exactly. And can we create new jobs that those people can grow into? And that's why we started the barrel company. And that's why we started laying down stuff. And, you know, we'll be doing single barrels, creating brands. I created a whiskey, kind of a whiskey fest, for lack of a, you know, Premier Drams, trying to find other revenue streams, because not only do you have to create jobs that these people can work, like myself, who's in, you know, late 40s, but you need to be able to pay them. So if you can't just count on, you know, the revenue stream coming in from the restaurants and bars, if you're truly trying to create something bigger than that, where you can pay people more than that, you've got to find these other avenues. Yeah. So it's just like the restaurants are just right now kind of a way for us to, it's our base, it's our core, but we need to be thinking so much bigger than that if we're going to have room for people to grow.
Right, and stay in the business. And then finally, because this is what happens when you drink whiskey, is eventually you talk about what would be your death row meal, what's that last meal. You know, we've had these conversations, you taste something and you go, yeah, this would be one of the last things I would ever want to eat in my life. But
I mean, that's for me, that's an easy one, and that would be Maryland blue crabs.
Really?
For sure. Absolutely.
Wow. I've never had that answer. Not that I don't love Maryland blue crabs.
But. Yeah, that's a no-brainer for me. I was a vegetarian actually for 15 years, and blue crabs was the last thing I ate before I became a vegetarian, and it was the first thing I ate when I stopped being a vegetarian. So where we grew up, you know, growing up in the Washington metropolitan area, that whole ritual of a crab feast and your friends, and it's so much bigger than even the food itself. Mm-hmm. That would be it. You know, a big glass of milk. I have to admit, that's my favorite beverage.
Whole milk, raw milk, 2%.
I will take whatever milk. Do you have milk? Do you have milk here?
I actually also have a real big thing for milk. I've written a lot about milk, which is so weird.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, I'm a milk writer. Well, on that note, I don't think the crab and milk would go together.
Cream of crab soup? Well, come on. There you go. Let's compromise there. Even though I'm more partial to vegetable crab. But anyway.
Okay. Vegetable. I mean, we have she crab soup here. You might really enjoy that if you haven't had it, but.
Yeah, you got some here too.
Yeah,
as well.
we can call.
I am getting hungry now. This podcast is getting.
Well, great. Well, if people want to learn more about Bill Thomas and his amazing building of a whiskey culture in Washington D.C. and beyond, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. We're going to have links there so that you can connect directly to his restaurants and bars, as well as some imagery so you can see, of course, beautiful, beautiful bottles of whiskey. And as I always like to say, the face behind that voice. If you like what you hear, you know, this is what I like to do. It kind of pays off sometimes. I get to have amazing sips of whiskey while I talk to people that have the most interesting jobs. I mean, forget this commercial, the most interesting man in the world. I've met multiples, so please tell your friends, subscribe, rate, and review, and we will talk with you next time. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, and welcome to Talking With My Mouthful. It took an extra day to get this out this week because I did not have a Southern Fork approved voice for most of the week. The South is really having a big pollen year this year, and I succumbed to it. I wasn't able to really talk without coughing for a few days. So on the backside of that, so I'm going to make this quick for you today. I just want to mention, if you are into cooking in your home kitchen, something you might want to check out if you still like Facebook, still find joy in Facebook, is a Facebook group called the Savour Cookbook Club. It is run by Savour Magazine, and I'm a contributor for them. And each month, the Cookbook Club moderators choose a cookbook. It doesn't have to be a new one. And it doesn't, you know, I know this is Southern Fork, but it's not usually Southern. And then people cook from it throughout the month and share their impressions, take pictures of their dishes, talk about their substitutions, what worked, what didn't work. And it's a great place to share with other cooks if you are interested in learning how to cook better or having a little task for yourself to become a better cook or a more engaged cook in your own kitchen. So I've had the opportunity to be involved with this cookbook club for a few months now, and I've really enjoyed just watching it. I've also added to it a couple times. I have written a few articles where I was able to interview, for Savour, I was able to interview Dori Greenspan, who is a wonderful cookbook author, very well known, as well as Julia Tertian, another outstanding cookbook author. So my articles added to this cookbook club craze, but also it got me inspired to cook from it. So you might want to check that out. It's the Savour Cookbook Club. This isn't a paid endorsement. This is just me telling you what I'm doing when I'm not recording on the Southern Fork or coughing with allergies. So anyway, hope you have a wonderful holiday weekend, and I will talk with you soon. You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?